The next category of cases addresses the liability of medical facilities, drug treatment facilities, residential care facilities, and doctors for assaults by patients or residents. The key concepts here are whether the facility or doctor can legitimately exercise control over the assailant, and if so, whether there was adequate supervision. The first case in the materials, Jennings, is mentioned briefly because it deals with video evidence. Medical and residential facilities may have video surveillance. Here, the plaintiff's attorney requested that any video evidence be preserved, but it wasn't. The case dealt solely with the proper remedy for the apparently inadvertent destruction of the video evidence. Although the facts were not described in the decision, the case stemmed from an assault on the plaintiff by another patient in a regional medical center. The complaint alleged negligent supervision on the part of the medical facility. The decision only addressed the issue of spoliation of evidence. Plaintiff's attorney had sent a letter to the facility asking that all records of the incident, including videotape, be preserved. The videotape was not preserved, apparently because the attorney's letter was not forwarded to the right department. The trial court ruled the medical center could not introduce any evidence that the assailant was being supervised at the time of the assault. The second department found that remedy to be too harsh. Because the plaintiff's case could be established without the videotape, the proper remedy was an adverse inference jury instruction. And I should mention that the existence of surveillance video should be investigated in almost any of these cases. Obviously, the restaurants and bars and apartment houses and so forth probably also have video surveillance. In the next case, Odo, plaintiff was punched and stabbed by Sean Valensis, who had just been released from the defendant mental health facility. Valensis was intoxicated and got into a violent physical confrontation with another resident. He was discharged for violating the facility's rules. Because he became enraged and acted out of control as he was being discharged, the police were called and they escorted Valensis out of the facility. Shortly thereafter, Valensis assaulted the plaintiff, who was his mother's boyfriend. The complaint alleged the facility negligently released Valensis. The motion court denied the facility's motion for summary judgment, and the First Department affirmed. Reversing the appellate division, the Court of Appeals held the facility was not liable because Valensis was not under the facility's control at the time he assaulted the plaintiff. In the court's words, generally, there is no duty to control the conduct of third persons to prevent them from causing injury to others. Liability for the negligent acts of third persons generally arises when the defendant has authority to control the actions of such third persons. This is so even where, as a practical matter, the defendant could have exercised control. The court emphasized the facility was not a prison, and the facility's control over Valensis was entirely dependent upon his willingness to comply with and carry out its directives. Because the facility did not have the authority to prevent Valensis from leaving, when Valensis left, the facility was no longer under a duty to control his conduct. In the next case, Stephen, the plaintiffs were employees of a residential facility which temporarily housed persons with mental illness, often after they had been discharged from a psychiatric facility. Due to threats he made to staff, a resident of the facility was admitted to defendant hospital for 24-hour observation under the mental hygiene law. He was discharged the next day back to the residential facility. 4 days later, he assaulted the three plaintiffs. The complaint alleged psychiatric malpractice. The court explained that doctors and their employers cannot be liable for an assault by a patient released from their care if the release is a matter of professional judgment. A plaintiff must show that the decision to release the patient was something less than a professional medical determination based upon careful examination of the patient. Evidence of a difference of opinion among experts does not provide an adequate basis for a prima facie case of malpractice. In support of its motion for summary judgment, the hospital demonstrated that over the 24-hour period of observation, the assailant calmed down, took his medication, slept through the night, ate breakfast with a good appetite, was able to follow directions, and denied having hallucinations or delusions. He was examined for 20 to 25 minutes in the morning before he was discharged and remained calm and coherent throughout, with no evidence of a lack of impulse control. The assailant, therefore, did not meet the criteria for involuntary psychiatric observation at the time he was discharged. In the next case, Malone. Plaintiff sued a doctor who operated a pain management clinic, alleging that the doctor operated a pill mill and wrongfully provided drugs to a drug addict. The drug addict shot and killed plaintiff's decedent and three others during a robbery of a drugstore in an attempt to steal narcotics. Generally, there's no duty to control the conduct of third persons to prevent them from causing injury to others, even where, as a practical matter, the defendant could have exercised such control. Courts have imposed a duty to control the conduct of others only where there is a special relationship between the defendant and the assailant. A special relationship stems from the authority and ability to exercise control over the actions of the assailant. Here, the doctor did not owe a duty to the decedent or to the general public because no special relationship with the assailant existed. The doctor did not have the authority or ability to control the actions of the shooter. In the next case, Malave, or perhaps Malave, M-A-L-A-V-E, plaintiff was a resident of an adult care facility who was stabbed by another resident in the lobby. Plaintiff sued the facility, alleging the facility had a duty to protect him from assaults by other residents. An adult care facility is defined as a family-type home for adults, a shelter for adults, a residence for adults, or an adult home, which provides temporary or long-term residential care and services to adults who, though not requiring continual medical or nursing care, are, by reason of physical or other limitations associated with age, physical or mental disabilities, or other factors, unable or substantially unable to live independently. Here the residents were free to come and go as they pleased. To remove a resident from the facility, an eviction proceeding was required. The facility did not require the issuance of day passes, which would have indicated a certain level of authority and control over the residents who did not relinquish general autonomy. In this context, a duty of care only arises when there is a special relationship between the facility and the assailant. A special relationship exists only when the facility has sufficient authority and ability to control the conduct of residents, which was not the case here. In the next case, Schnorr, plaintiff's decedent was a resident in the memory care unit of defendant assisted living facility. He was assaulted by another resident. The court flatly stated that the assisted living facility had a duty to safeguard patients and residents even from injuries inflicted by third parties. The duty to protect is measured by the capacity of the resident to provide for his or her own safety. The court explained that this sliding scale of duty does not render a facility an insurer of resident safety or require it to keep each resident under constant surveillance. Rather, the scope of the facility's duty is defined by those risks which are reasonably foreseeable. Here, the assisted living facility was deemed to owe a heightened duty of care to residents of the memory care unit, given the nature of their ailments, for instance, Alzheimer's, dementia, and memory loss. So, unlike the adult care facility in Malave, the case we just looked at, where the residents were free to leave the facility without permission, and the court found no duty to protect, here, in the memory unit of the assisted living facility, the duty to protect was stated as black letter law. And unlike the Malave case, here the analysis did not focus on the ability to control the residents, but rather focused on whether the assault was foreseeable. Supreme Court had granted the assisted living facility's motion for summary judgment. The Fourth Department reversed, finding that the facility's motion did not present any evidence demonstrating the assault was not foreseeable. Instead, defendants' motion papers pointed to flaws in the plaintiff's proof. As we have seen again and again, a defendant must present affirmative proof negating essential elements of the plaintiff's case, or summary judgment will be denied without considering the opposing papers. Here, the defendant failed to submit any evidence to show that it was not aware of any danger of assault presented by the assailant, and therefore failed to demonstrate it was entitled to judgment as a matter of law. So, to review the issues that came up in this particular category of liability of medical facilities, drug treatment facilities, residential care facilities, and doctors for assaults by patients or residents. The first case we looked at was included just to raise the issue of spoliation of video evidence, because video evidence may be available in almost all of these third-party assault cases. Even if the video doesn't show the assault, it may show the level of security or supervision afforded by the defendant. Plaintiffs should request that it be preserved and seek sanctions if it isn't. In Odo, the assailant was free to leave the drug treatment facility because the treatment depended on his willing participation. Even though the assailant was discharged because of violence and had to be escorted off the premises by the police, the facility could not be held liable for his subsequent assault of his mother's boyfriend. The facility didn't have the authority to control the assailant, therefore no duty to protect others from the assailant arose. In Stephen, the court explained that doctors and their employers cannot be liable for an assault by a patient released from their care if the release is a matter of professional judgment. The complaint sounded in medical malpractice. A plaintiff must show that the decision to release the patient was something less than a professional medical determination based upon careful examination of the patient. The evidence in Stephen demonstrated the assailant's release was justified by an adequate professional assessment of his condition. As explained in the Malone case, generally, there is no duty to control the conduct of third persons to prevent them from causing injury to others, even where, as a practical matter, the defendant could have exercised that level of control. Courts have imposed a duty to control the conduct of others only where there is a special relationship between the defendant and the assailant. A special relationship stems from the authority and ability to exercise control over the actions of the assailant. In Malone, the assailant, a drug addict, had allegedly received drugs from the defendant doctor in the past. The doctor did not owe a duty to the decedent or to the general public because no special relationship with the assailant existed, and that the doctor did not have the authority or ability to control the actions of the shooter. In Malave, the residents of the adult care facility were free to come and go as they pleased. To remove a resident from the facility, an eviction proceeding was required. In this context, a duty of care would arise only if there is a special relationship between the facility and the assailant. A special relationship means the authority and ability to control the conduct of the assailant. Therefore, the facility was not liable for a resident-upon-resident assault in the lobby of the facility. In Schnorr, the assisted living facility was deemed to owe a heightened duty of care to residents of the memory care unit given the nature of their ailments, such as Alzheimer's, dementia, and memory loss. So, unlike the adult facility in the Malave case, the duty to protect was stated as black-letter law. And, unlike the Malave case, the analysis did not focus on the ability to control the residents, which was presumed, but rather on whether the assault was foreseeable. In Schnorr, Supreme Court had granted the assisted living facilities motion for summary judgment. The Fourth Department reversed, finding that the facility's motion did not present any evidence demonstrating the assault was not foreseeable. The defendant failed to submit any evidence to show that it was not aware of any danger of assault presented by the assailant, and therefore failed to demonstrate it was entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Another example of the rigid appellate analysis of summary judgment motions. Turning to the pattern jury instructions, there is a brief mention of residential facility liability at page 616 in volume 1A, that's the third edition, 2017 version. The release of a psychiatric patient may constitute malpractice. The medical malpractice discussion starts at page 2, volume 1B, again, that's the third edition, 2017 version. The next couple of cases arise from assaults in homeless shelters, one city-owned and one privately owned. Governmental immunity, liability of a private security company under contract principles, and the foreseeability of the attack are the key issues. In Clark versus City of New York, the first case in this section, plaintiff was assaulted in a city homeless shelter by two other residents. The city's obligation to provide security is a governmental function for which it cannot be held liable absent a special relationship with the plaintiff. There was no special relationship here. The plaintiff alleged the city failed to provide sufficient security. But because plaintiff's allegations implicated a governmental function, the city couldn't be held liable unless a special duty of care was owed to the plaintiff. The city demonstrated no special duty of care had been developed with the plaintiff. However, the private security company was not immune from suit under the umbrella of governmental immunity. Plaintiff was a third-party beneficiary of the contract between the city and the security company. According to the plaintiff, two men at the shelter, who had previously assaulted him, doused him with a flammable liquid which ignited. The two men, who had been moved out of plaintiff's room after the prior assault, were able to walk through the halls and enter his room at the shelter uninterrupted. The security company offered no evidence that the assault was unexpected or unforeseen. Without providing facts about prior criminal activity at the shelter, or the lack of criminal activity, the security company did not raise a question of fact about whether the assault was foreseeable. foreseeability is at the heart of the court's analysis. The defendant failed to address foreseeability in its motion papers, requiring the denial of the motion. In Corcoran, plaintiff's decedent was a resident of a private facility for disabled homeless people who was killed by another resident. Plaintiff sued the owner and operator of the facility. The fatal attack was immediately preceded by two prior physical attacks by the same resident, and police officers responding to the earlier attacks had told defendant's staff members to keep the two residents apart. Therefore, a question of fact was raised about whether the attack was foreseeable. The court acknowledged the theory that an intentional criminal assault can be a supervening act which severs the causal connection between a defendant's negligence and the injuries, but noted the theory does not apply where the criminal act itself is foreseeable. So to review the issues presented by the homeless shelter cases, in Clark, the city ran the shelter as a governmental function and was therefore immune from suit absent a special relationship with the victim. No special relationship was demonstrated. In Clark, there was a question of fact whether the security company breached its contract with the city based upon the foreseeability of the attack. The victim was deemed a third-party beneficiary of the contract between the city and the security company. In Corcoran, the court noted that an intentional assault does not break the causal chain between the defendant's acts or omissions and the injuries if the assault itself was foreseeable. With respect to the pattern jury instructions, the PJI includes a brief mention of the liability of residential facility operators on page 616 of Volume 1A. Again, that's the third edition, the 2017 version. At this point, I will insert the second verification code word. The second verification code word in this CLE is orange. Again, the second verification code word for the CLE is orange. The next category of cases concern the liability of a municipality, here counties and county sheriffs, for inmate-on-inmate assaults in jail. The county and sheriff have a duty to keep inmates safe, which includes protecting inmates from assaults by other inmates. In the first case in this section, Villar versus County of Erie, that's V-I-L-L-A-R, the county and the sheriff were sued by an inmate who alleged he was sexually assaulted twice by another inmate at the Erie County Jail. This appeal concerned motions to dismiss the complaint, not motions for summary judgment, so the analysis is limited to whether the inmate stated causes of action. The county argued the suit stemmed from discretionary acts, triggering governmental immunity. But the court didn't reach the governmental immunity issue because it required a factual inquiry which could not be addressed at the pleading stage. The court noted that absent a local law to the contrary, the county may not be held vicariously liable for the actions of the county sheriff or the sheriff's deputies. Municipalities owe a duty to inmates in correctional facilities to safeguard them from foreseeable assaults by other inmates. The municipality is not an insurer of the inmate safety, and negligence cannot be demonstrated by the mere occurrence of an inmate assault. The scope of the municipality's duty to protect inmates is limited to risks of harm that are reasonably foreseeable. In a companion case, Villar versus Howard, who was the Erie County Sheriff, which went up to the Court of Appeals, the court held, 1. Plaintiff did not need to file a notice of claim in the action against the sheriff because the county cannot, under the New York State Constitution, indemnify and defend the sheriff in connection with the action. 2. The complaint stated a cause of action in negligence, that being failure to keep an inmate safe. And 3. Governmental immunity is an affirmative defense on which the sheriff bears the burden of proof, which cannot be addressed at the pleading stage. The fact that the county provided law enforcement liability insurance for the sheriff did not obligate the county to defend and indemnify the sheriff, and therefore did not trigger the notice of claim requirement under the municipal law. The state is not an insurer of inmate safety and is not required to provide unremitting surveillance in all circumstances. The county owes a duty of care to safeguard inmates, even from attacks by fellow inmates. The sheriff is also required by law to keep jail inmates safe. In Wasserman, the second and last case in this category, the Third Department reversed Supreme Court, finding there was a question of fact whether the county defendants were negligent in failing to determine whether an inmate was violent. Plaintiff was assaulted by the inmate and alleged the county should have reviewed the inmate's past record of violent behavior before assigning the assailant to the general population. The county has a duty to safeguard inmates from attacks by fellow inmates. The duty is limited to protecting inmates from risks of harm that are reasonably foreseeable, that is, risks the county knew or should have known about. The regulations implementing Correction Law 500-B direct that the reviewing official at the jail who makes housing assignments must consider an inmate's attitude and behavior during present and prior incarcerations. The reviewing officer here did not consider the assailant's prior prison disciplinary records, and that omission constituted a violation of the regulation that is some evidence of negligence. So to review the issues raised in this section dealing with inmate upon inmate assaults, the county's duty to keep county jail inmates safe includes protecting the inmates from foreseeable assaults by other inmates. The sheriff, separate from the county, has a similar duty to keep county jail inmates safe. In the Villar case, the Court of Appeals held that absent a statute imposing vicarious liability upon the county for the actions or omissions of the sheriff, no notice of claim need be filed in an action against the sheriff. The liability insurance provided by the county for the sheriff's department in that Villar case did not obligate the county to defend and indemnify the sheriff, so the notice of claim requirement was not triggered by the policy. In the Wasserman case, the court noted that the failure to review an inmate's disciplinary record before placing him or her is a regulatory violation which constitutes some evidence of negligence. Turning to the pattern jury instructions, governmental tort liability for assaults on inmates is discussed at page 597 in volume 1B, that's the third edition, 2017 version. This next category of third-party assault cases addresses the liability for assaults by persons attending public gatherings like fairs, movie theaters, and spectator sports. The key concepts are the ability to control the assailant and the awareness of the need to control the assailant. Awareness of the need to control goes to the foreseeability of the assault. In the first case in this section, Bisignano, B-I-S-I-G-N-A-N-O, the plaintiff was attacked by two teenage boys at a church fair on property owned by the church. The case was analyzed under the concepts of the property owner's duty to control the assailants, which was directly linked to the concept of the foreseeability of the attack. An owner's duty to control the conduct of persons on the owner's property arises only when the owner has the opportunity to control them and is aware of the need for the control. In other words, the owner of a public establishment has no duty to protect patrons against unforeseeable and unexpected assaults. Here the plaintiff raised a question of fact, whether the assault was foreseeable. The plaintiffs presented a transcript of the deposition testimony of the plaintiff's girlfriend, who explained that approximately 30 minutes before the assault, she spoke to a security guard at the fair and advised him that there was a confrontation and that it was getting worse. The evidence raised a triable issue of fact about whether the assault was foreseeable and whether the property owner was aware of the need to take further security measures. In the next case, Solomon, the plaintiffs were assaulted in defendant's movie theater, and the theater moved for summary judgment. The theater would owe a duty to control the assailants only if it had the opportunity to control them and was aware of the need to control them. In other words, to hold the theater liable, the assault must have been foreseeable. The deposition submitted in support of the theater's motion for summary judgment revealed that there had been four or five similar incidents, and one of the plaintiffs screamed for help throughout the 15 to 20 minute assault. A question of fact had been raised about the foreseeability of the attack by the defendant's papers. Therefore, there wasn't any need to consider the plaintiff's papers. In the next case, Pink, the Court of Appeals reversed the appellate division and found that the defendant Youth Hockey Association was not liable for an assault by one spectator on another spectator, which took place after the game was over. The players were 13 years old, and most of the spectators were parents. During the game, several on-ice fights broke out between the players, who received penalties and in some cases were ejected from the game. The referee also ejected a coach for throwing an object onto the ice. The spectators, mostly family members of the players, participated in yelling and name-calling. The game concluded without any physical fights in the stands. After the game was over, two female spectators got into a fight in the stands, and a melee quickly developed as several others, including the plaintiff, stepped in to break up the fight. The brother of one of the two female spectators involved in the fight assaulted plaintiff. An assault like this had never happened before. The court distinguished between a property owner's duty and the foreseeability of a risk. There is a duty to control the conduct of third persons when a defendant has the opportunity to control them and is aware of the need for such control. That duty includes minimizing the danger of foreseeable criminal conduct. Foreseeability and duty are not identical concepts. Foreseeability determines the scope of the duty once the duty is determined to exist. The scope of the duty is defined by past experience. Here, the assault was not foreseeable. The defendant took measures to address player and spectator conduct, but the behavior of the fans did not create the risk that the failure to eject a specific spectator would lead to a criminal assault, especially since such an assault had never occurred before. The plaintiff also argued that defendant's failure to enforce the zero-tolerance policy by ejecting spectators constituted an independent evidence of negligence. The policy provides that the on-ice official will remove spectators using obscene, racial, or vulgar language from the game. The violation of an organization's internal rules is not negligence in and of itself, and where an internal policy exceeds the standard of ordinary care, it cannot serve as a basis for imposing liability. Nor did the policy demonstrate that defendant was on notice of the likelihood of criminal assaults, since a general awareness of incidents nationwide does not establish foreseeability. In the last case in this section, Garda, plaintiff was an employee of a movie theater, which had contracted for security with defendant security company. One of the security guards ordered plaintiff to go to the rear of the theater and restrain an intoxicated person in the alley. That person assaulted the plaintiff. Plaintiff sued the theater and the security company. The security company moved to dismiss the complaint, alleging plaintiff was not a third-party beneficiary of its contract with the theater. The court agreed there was no contractual liability, but found the complaint stated a cause of action in negligence. The allegations in the complaint set forth a legal theory under which the security company could be found to have assumed a duty of care to the plaintiff by calling for and instructing him to investigate, restrain, and detain the intoxicated person in the alley. The court explained that a duty of care may be assumed where a defendant's conduct placed plaintiff in a more vulnerable position than plaintiff would have been in had the defendant done nothing, or where a defendant's conduct enhanced the risk that plaintiff faced, created a new risk, or induced plaintiff to forego some opportunity to avoid the risk. So to sum up the issues in this section dealing with assaults at public gatherings, fairs, movie theaters, and spectator sports. In the Bisignano case, the plaintiff was attacked by two teenage boys at a church fair on property owned by the church. Plaintiff's girlfriend, 30 minutes before the assault, spoke to a security guard at the fair and advised him that there was a confrontation and that it was getting worse. This evidence raised a tribal issue of fact about whether the assault was foreseeable and whether the property owner was aware of the need to take further security measures. In Solomon, the deposition submitted by the defendant theater demonstrated there had been four or five similar incidents, and one of the plaintiffs screamed for help throughout the 15 to 20 minute assault. The defendant theater presented this evidence, so the theater's motion for summary judgment was denied without the need to look at the opposing papers. In Pink, the defendant Youth Hockey Association was not liable for an assault by one spectator on another spectator, which took place after the game was over. No similar assault had occurred in the past. The Court of Appeals explained that foreseeability determines the scope of the duty once the duty is determined to exist, and the scope of a duty is defined by past experience. The assault in Pink was not foreseeable. The behavior of the fans did not create the risk that the failure to eject a specific spectator would lead to a criminal assault, especially since such an assault had never occurred before. In Pink, the Youth Hockey Association had a zero-tolerance policy, providing that the on-ice official will remove spectators using obscene, racial, or vulgar language from the game. The Court of Appeals noted that the violation of an organization's internal rules is not negligence in and of itself, and where an internal policy exceeds the standard of ordinary care, it cannot serve as a basis for imposing liability. The policy did not demonstrate that defendant was on notice of the likelihood of criminal assaults, since a general awareness of incidents nationwide does not establish foreseeability. In the Garda case, a theater employee sued the security company, which directed him to restrain an intoxicated person who was on the theater premises. The complaint was deemed to state a common law negligence cause of action. A duty of care may arise where a defendant's conduct places plaintiff in a more vulnerable position than plaintiff would have been in had defendant done nothing, or where a defendant's conduct enhanced the risk that plaintiff faced, created a new risk, or induced plaintiff to forego some opportunity to avoid the risk. With respect to the pattern jury instructions, there is a very brief mention of liability for assault at public gatherings on page 617, volume 1A, 3rd edition, 2017 version. The next category of third-party assault cases addresses the liability of landowners or hosts for assaults by guests at a party. The central issues are whether the defendant had the ability to control the behavior of the guest and whether the defendant was aware of the need to control the guest. In the first case in this category, Pettit, the plaintiff was at a party and was assaulted by another partygoer. The party was hosted by one of the defendants and held at a golf course owned by another defendant. The golf course, the absent landowner, was granted summary judgment. The court analyzed the case under the concept of control. A landowner has a duty to control the conduct of third persons on the property only when the landowner has the opportunity to control that person and is aware of the need for the control. A landowner who is not present at the time of an assault does not have notice of the conduct or control over the assailant. An absent landowner, therefore, has no duty to protect one partygoer from an assault by another partygoer unless there is a special relationship between the landowner and the host of the party. Exactly what a special relationship with the party host would look like was not explained, but no special relationship was found here. In the next case, Colon, the plaintiff, a college student, alleged he was assaulted by three unidentified people as he was leaving a party hosted by a plaintiff at her home. He sued the 18-year-old host of the party and her father. Apparently, plaintiff alleged the assailants were intoxicated and had been at the party. The second department determined plaintiff's common law negligence cause of action was properly dismissed. The facts are not described in the decision. As for the law, the court explained, under common law negligence, a landowner may have responsibility for injuries caused by an intoxicated guest. Liability may be imposed only for injuries that occurred on defendant's property or in an area under the defendant's control, where the defendant had the opportunity to supervise the intoxicated guest and was reasonably aware of the need for such control. Without awareness of the risk or threat, there is no duty. In the next case, Morris, plaintiff sued the owner of property where another defendant hosted a party. Plaintiff was assaulted by someone who was also at the party. Here, the absent property owner successfully moved to dismiss the complaint for failure to state a cause of action. The complaint failed to allege the absent property owner had the ability and opportunity to control the assailant and was aware of the need to control the assailant. Without those allegations, there was no showing the absent landowner owed a duty of care to protect the plaintiff from an assault by another partygoer. The complaint also did not allege that the assault was foreseeable. To state a cause of action against a property owner for an assault on the property, the complaint must allege the property owner had the ability and opportunity to control the assailant and was aware of the need to control the assailant. Presumably, evidence of those essential elements would constitute evidence the assault was foreseeable, which was separately mentioned as an essential element. In the next case, Haman. The plaintiff was assaulted at a party held by the 18-year-old daughter of the property owners. Apparently, the assailant was also a partygoer and was intoxicated. The parents successfully moved for summary judgment. They submitted evidence they were out of town when their daughter held the party, they had not authorized their daughter to hold the party, and they had no prior knowledge about the party. The parents also presented evidence they had no knowledge their daughter had held parties in their absence in the past. Property owners may be responsible for injuries caused by an intoxicated guest if the injuries occurred on their property or in an area under the property owner's control. The property owners must have the opportunity to supervise the intoxicated guest and must be aware of the need to supervise the guest. Without awareness of the risk or threat posed by the guest, there is no duty to the plaintiff. In the last case in this section, Holiday, the plaintiff was injured in a fight outside a fraternity house on the Cornell campus. Plaintiff was walking across the street from a group of people outside the defendant fraternity house when he heard the assailant make a racial slur. Plaintiff crossed the street, approached the assailant, and started arguing with him. The assailant moved away from where the initial confrontation took place, and plaintiff followed, screaming and arguing with the assailant, who then stabbed the plaintiff. The assailant, who was not a member of the fraternity, was intoxicated when he arrived at the fraternity house and had little or nothing to drink there. He was physically ejected from the fraternity house after he started arguing with a member of the fraternity. The argument was continuing outside the fraternity house as the plaintiff was walking by across the street. The fraternity's motion for summary judgment dismissing the negligence cause of action was properly granted. A defendant may be liable for injuries caused by an intoxicated guest that occurred on the defendant's property or in an area under the defendant's control, only where the defendant had the opportunity to control the intoxicated guest and was reasonably aware of the need for such control. The fraternity demonstrated that the plaintiff's injuries occurred in an area not under its control. Therefore, the fraternity had no duty to supervise or control the assailant's conduct in that area. To sum up the issues raised in this category, injury at a hosted party. In Pettit, the court explained a landowner has a duty to control the conduct of third persons on the property only when the landowner has the opportunity to control the person and is aware of the need for the control. A landowner who is not present at the time of an assault does not have notice of the conduct or control over the assailant. The Pettit Court explained that an absent landowner therefore has no duty to protect one partygoer from an assault by another partygoer unless there is a special relationship between the landowner and the host of the party. Exactly what a special relationship with the party host would look like was not explained, but no special relationship was found there. In Colon, the court explained that liability may be imposed only for injuries that occurred on a defendant's property or in an area under the defendant's control, where the defendant had the opportunity to supervise the intoxicated guest and was reasonably aware of the need for that control. Without awareness of the risk or threat, there is no duty. The Morris Court explained that to state a cause of action against the property owner for an assault on the property, the complaint must allege the property owner had the ability and opportunity to control the assailant and was aware of the need to control the assailant. In Haman, the plaintiff was assaulted at a party held by the 18-year-old daughter of the property owners. The parents successfully moved for summary judgment. They submitted evidence they were out of town when their daughter held the party. They had not authorized their daughter to hold the party, and they had no prior knowledge that a party would be held. The parents also presented evidence they had no knowledge their daughter had held parties in their absence in the past. In Holiday, the plaintiff was injured in a fight outside a fraternity house on the Cornell campus. The assailant, who was not a member of the fraternity, was intoxicated when he arrived at the fraternity house and had little or nothing to drink there. He was physically ejected from the fraternity house after he started arguing with a member of the fraternity. The argument was continuing outside the fraternity house as plaintiff was walking by across the street. The fraternity demonstrated that the plaintiff's injuries occurred in an area not under its control. Therefore, the fraternity had no duty to supervise or control the assailant's conduct in that area. With respect to the pattern jury instructions, liability for assaults by partygoers is addressed briefly at pages 618, 619 of Volume 1A, that's the third edition, 2017 version. We've come to the end of part two of this CLE of three parts. Again, this CLE is called Liability and Negligence for an Assault by a Third Party.